we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. Harvey Risch, Professor Emeritus of Epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health. Today, we're continuing our new weekly series with various interesting and accomplished people. Our topics are mostly on things scientific and COVID, but who knows where we might get to. And if listeners have questions for me, please submit them at americaoutloud.com/pulse. I'm pleased to introduce today's guest, Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who's professor of medicine at Stanford University, also senior fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research, and also at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, and also at the Hoover Institution. And I'm sure that everyone knows that Dr. Bhattacharya was one of the three principals of the Great Barrington Declaration. Jay, so let's begin. What have you been thinking about lately?
I've been thinking about Stanford, actually, about where I teach, and I've taught for the last 20 some years. Although I've been mostly avoiding talking publicly about how difficult it's been to work at Stanford the last 3 years, because I wanted to focus my efforts on my advocacy about the pandemic, I think it's time that I start telling people a little bit about what happened to me at Stanford during the pandemic, and basically to almost anyone else who spoke up against the lockdown narratives during the pandemic.
I think that we've seen in a microcosm of our area of science and medicine something that's been much more general in the political takeover, the largely political takeover of originally the social sciences, and then recently getting into the natural sciences, of the university life as a whole. And, you know, it's basically what I've been saying for a long time is that people defend themselves to the degree that they have material to use to validly defend themselves. And people use censorship when they can't defend themselves. And so political arguments that use censorship rather than defense are ones that know they've lost the battle before they start. And so what we've experienced, you know, to the degree that we've experienced censorship, you more than average, is traceable back to the fact that the other side has very little material to defend itself with and doesn't use it. And it's consistent with everything we've been seeing in academia for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it is definitely true, Harvey, and I agree that people who have power that resort to censorship often do so because their arguments are weak. And I go a corollary to that by not permitting the free exchange of ideas, it actually makes arguments weak. Like you don't test the arguments, the limits of the arguments against people who have, you know, different ideas. You're just not going to know how far your ideas actually go. You'll overstate. You'll make mistakes. The thing is, I mean, I had always thought about a place like Stanford or Yale as a place where you could fight against that. That would be the very last places where there would be kind of suppression of alternate ideas, especially held by tenured faculty within the norms of our institutions involve essentially complete freedom for professors to say and think what they'd like. Now, of course, you're subject to peers saying that you've got it wrong. All the normal kinds of mechanisms of science by which people learn about whether the ideas are, which ideas are right and which ideas are wrong. You know, you and I may disagree about something. We work together and figure out an experiment to test who's right or which idea is right. And that experiment comes out, turns out you're right. I change my mind. And then we go on to the next thing, right? That is the normal way that science works in a university setting. The problem is that nothing like that normal process actually played itself out during the pandemic, especially for people that held views outside of the sort of the Fauci lockdown, you know, sort of approach and line to the pandemic.
Well, I think that those people who did that were only the agents of forces that were controlling them. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, who in the whole pandemic had an interest in pushing all of that? And I think there are multiple interests. I think that basically any entity that saw benefit to being on that side grafted itself into the corruption to take advantage. So I think pharma instigated a lot of it, but may not have been totally responsible for it, but abetted it from the get-go. In fact, from, you know, with all the Moderna patent stuff and making the virus in the first place, that Wuhan or whatever lab that made it, I think they knew it was coming, and they were poising themselves to have the vaccine ready ASAP because they knew that it was coming. But I don't think that it got out necessarily intentionally. I think it got out by accident, and we had a national security interest in obliterating any leads to how it really got out, because it likely involved the United States every bit as much as China. And so we have national security interests that are above pharma that are likely pushing the restriction on knowledge, information, the origin story, and all that.
You know, I think if you think back to January 2020, actually there are a whole bunch of FOIA emails, FOIA, you know, Freedom of Information Act emails that have come out that show discussion between Tony Fauci and a whole bunch of his colleagues inside the NIH and outside, and a few virologists outside who were NIH grantees and favorites of Tony Fauci. In those early days, January 2020, Tony Fauci spent a lot of his time and effort trying to tamp down the idea that the virus might have been a lab leak out of the lab, that the leak out of the lab was a lab that the NIH actually had supported. They created this idea, this illusion that it was a conspiracy theory to even suggest such a thing, that it was somehow racist or scientifically indefensible that such an idea could come about. And then they systematically went about trying to destroy the careers of anybody who disagreed with them on this.
Yeah.
Tony Fauci sits on $6-7 billion of funding. The NIH itself funds $45 billion of research. And it's not just, as you know, Harvey, because you know, as you know full well from your position, it's not just that the NIH money gives you the ability to run the scientific experiments you want. It's also that that money confers social status within academic medicine, right? So I'm sure it's similar at Yale, but in the School of Medicine, where I was an assistant professor at Stanford, if I didn't get an NIH grant, it would have been very difficult for me to get tenure.
Oh, well, yeah, of course. I mean, that's standard. Independent, you know, grant funding from some magnitude covering a big chunk of your time is de rigueur for getting tenure. It proves your academic competence. Whether it comes from NIH or pharma or somewhere else depends on the scope of your projects and how much it costs to do them.
I mean, but the point is that NIH has a tremendous influence on the careers of scientists in academic institutions. So when Tony Fauci organizes a campaign to make it seem like if you think that the virus might have leaked from the Wuhan lab, that it's a conspiracy theory, that you're somehow a bad scientist, it has a tremendous silencing effect on other scientists. It makes scientists and academic administrators behave in ways that do not fit the mission of our universities. It makes it so that they will use the power they have to marginalize even tenured professors and put tremendous pressure to silence the speech of professors that disagree with Tony Fauci. It's almost impossible to convey the extent of that power. I frankly, I wouldn't have known about it had I not experienced it very directly myself from my experience with the Great Barrington Declaration.
So did you feel it in the way your grants were reviewed or something like that?
Well, you know, I'm sure you've had this experience. It's hard to get NIH grants. I applied for 3 NIH grants during the pandemic, which I didn't get, but it's normal to like not have NIH grants funded. I have a pretty good hit rate, but it's not like unheard of to go for 3. So yeah. I don't know that I don't know it's that direct. What I think is, so the Stanford, I think some earns something on the order of $500 million a year in grants from the NIH. It's a substantial chunk of.
Yeah, we're similar. Yale similar.
And now what that means is that there's a vested interest in the administration to make sure that that there's people at the university are not on the other side of a major health policy question like COVID from Tony Fauci. I'll tell you what I know happened with certainty. So when Tony Fauci got an email from Francis Collins 4 days after I wrote the Great Barrington Declaration with Harvard professor Martin Kulldorff and Sunetra Gupta from Oxford, the email said, call the 3 of us fringe epidemiologists.
Right, I've read that correspondence. I know if you're fringe, but that makes the rest of the field fools.
Well, I mean, a friend of mine like gave me a card that says fringe epidemiologist on it. Like it'll be on my epitaph when I die. The thing is like he then called for devastating takedown of the premises. Now that then he like they I started getting like calls from reporters asking me why I want to let the virus rip, essentially why I want to kill people on campus. You know, I started getting death threats on campus. There was a tremendous campaign to silence me. Like so, the you would think that at a major university like Stanford, when there's a major policy issue, you know, basically the central policy issue of the entire world, how should we manage lockdowns? And you have a prominent faculty member writing with other prominent faculty members from around the university, tens of thousands of people signing. I mean, you signed too, Harvey. Very prominent professors from around the world saying, look, the lockdowns we've been doing are tremendously destructive. There's this age gradient in the mortality risk from COVID. Why not take advantage of that?
Right, because that's too much common sense. You know, no, nobody's ox gets gored if you do it that way.
Exactly. You have a conflict within science. You have on the one hand Tony Fauci and Francis Collins saying lockdown, 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 and then you have like all these like prominent scientists, including Nobel Prize winners and epidemiologists and infectious disease specialists, saying no, we don't need to lock down. What we need is focused protection of vulnerable people and lifting lockdown because it's causing so much harm to people. What would you have done if you were the head of the NIH? Well, you have two choices. You could either actually engage in a respectful debate, or you could demonize and destroy the people that opposed you. I mean, they chose the second.
That's what he's been doing for his whole career, is following the second path, because that's worked so well for him, especially during the AIDS epidemic.
Well, even you have to go that far. He did it during the COVID pandemic on the origins issue. The same modus operandi. And on campus, what would you do if you are the university president? What would you do if you are a university president? You have on campus what looks to you like a dissident voice, but the dissident voice is a faculty member that's been on the faculty for 20 some years, is a full tenured faculty member, in the School of Medicine. And you're saying things that are opposed to the lockdown narrative that's supported by the NIH, which funds the university for $500 million. What would you do? I mean, the commitments of the university, the motto of the university is "Let the winds of freedom blow."
Right.
Would you like a debate between prominent proponents of the lockdowns versus this dissident professor. It's not just me either. There's John Ioannidis, although he didn't sign the declaration. He's writing
incredible
science. Yeah, he's in, and all sort of all of his scientific work is pointing in the direction away from lockdowns. There's Michael Levitt, who's a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. There's Scott Atlas, who was the advisor to President Trump, arguing against lockdowns. So there's a fair number of very senior people inside the university that disagrees with the lockdown consensus. So what do you do as the president of the university?
You call the attorneys. You call the university attorneys. And ask them exactly what should I do.
That's exactly. I mean, I had a really interesting experience. Like in December of 2020, the former president of the university wrote to me, John Hennessy, who I absolutely adore, and he wrote and said he invited me to participate in a debate or discussion about COVID policy. And then he wrote to a number of prominent people on the other side of the debate at the university and asked them to join in. This is the former president of the university.
Right.
None of them agreed. I got to see the correspondence. I mean, they gave one horrible, dumb excuse after another. And he finally threw up his hands and said he couldn't do it, couldn't organize it. Of course, he couldn't force anybody to do it. In my own department, which is now the Department of Health, which turned like then it was I was in is inside the school, the Department of Medicine. Now I'm in the Department of Health Policy, but we focus on health policy, right? Health policy is contentious thing. Everyone disagrees about everything on health policy. It's normal to have debates and discussions. There's this attempt to try to get a debate going that fails. The head of my department basically puts the question to a bunch of people in the department who basically believe that anyone that disagreed with them on the pandemic was fringe, and even though they're my colleagues, even though they're
I think they're afraid to lose, and they know that they'll lose, and I think that if they were so sure of their arguments, they would have brashly come out and said, "Of course, I'll debate. I can wipe the floor with his arguments." You know. But they didn't have that because.
And if they did, if they wiped the floor with my arguments, Harvey, I would have changed my mind.
Right, of course. That's what science is.
So, it was funny because, like, JAMA actually did platform a debate between me and Mark Lipsitch of Harvard in November of 2020. And so, like, it's not that there was never no debate, it's just the academic institution where I work and live didn't allow a platform to have this discussion. And I mean, I think that's a violation of academic freedom. Like, academic freedom is not simply to me, you don't fire dissident professors. Like, that's the minimum. I'd call that negative academic freedom versus like negative rights are like, Congress passes no law prohibiting speech. Positive rights are like, we encourage a culture where free speech is the norm. It's a violation of our social norm to like even think about censoring or suppressing. The same thing happens to academic freedom. Okay, they didn't fire me, but they didn't have any. They basically made it socially difficult to express my views.
Right, they censored you indirectly, not officially, but indirectly. They censor you. Let me interrupt that. We're getting close to our commercial break time, so we'll take a break and we'll be right back.
We know you love the versatility and portability of the Genesis Fogger, but sometimes you just want to set it and forget it. Well, we heard you. Introducing the UX4 HOCL Atomizer. This stationary unit quietly protects you and is perfect for smaller spaces. With over 250,000 units sold in Japan, it's now available in the United States. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud to see the UX4 in action and receive a 15% discount on either Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you're ready for anything.
Hello, I'm Ben Marble, MD, and I founded MyFreeDoctor.com as a donation-supported, faith-based nonprofit with a mission to save lives by delivering free doctor visits to patients in all 50 states of America. MyFreeDoctor.com treats a broad range of health concerns like COVID-19, long COVID, sinus infections, urinary tract infections, rashes, medication refills, and more. So please visit MyFreeDoctor.com, where we're healing America one person at a time.
For 40 years, alarmists have been warning of a climate catastrophe, yet none of their dire predictions have come true. Temperatures have not soared, sea level rise has not been unusual, and extreme weather events have not increased in either frequency or intensity. In short, there is no climate emergency. For 15 years, the International Climate Science Coalition has led the call for climate realism and a Made in America climate plan, a plan based on real science that responds to the real world needs of Americans, supports economic growth, and strengthens our essential infrastructure. A plan that protects the environment and ensures that Americans can enjoy the blessings of clean air, clean land, and clean water for generations to come. It's time to put ideology and pseudoscience aside. It's time for a sensible climate plan. For more information or to donate, visit our website, icsc-climate.com.
Welcome back. This is Dr. Harvey Rich with Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. So we were just talking about positive and negative academic freedom.
Yeah. So, with negative academic freedom, it just says you don't fire a tenured professor for their thoughts. By the way, many universities failed on that front.
Oh, yeah.
There are people I know who signed the Great Barrington Declaration that lost their jobs in academic institutions as a result of their advocacy against lockdowns and other renegade ideas that they might have had.
Well, academic freedom doesn't exist until it's tested.
Yeah.
You can say anything you want about it, but until it's tested and proven that it actually exists, it's non-existent.
It is. I agree. And it's the hard cases that make it academic freedom.
Exactly.
It's cases where, like, there's a lot of faculty that hold one position very strongly and other faculty disagree with them. Do those dissident faculty have a place in the university? Can they be platformed within the university? If the answer is no in the hardest cases, then academic freedom doesn't exist at all.
Well, we have a tradition from our Woodward Report of 1974 of formal academic freedom that the university has held pretty well through the whole time. In fact, it's better than the Chicago report, but at least Chicago is more recent and people know about it. When I started with hydroxychloroquine stuff, my dean kind of grudgingly came out and supported it, saying that I was a contrarian, but I had my rights to speak my mind. You know, I didn't like being branded as a contrarian because I'm not a contrarian, actually. Except maybe in things COVID, you know, but that's, I'm not naturally contrary. I'm naturally skeptical and critical.
A good scientist, Harvey. That's what you are. I mean, like you have to look at the evidence and you make your own independent judgment based on the evidence. And, you know, with anything in science, we're all human, right? We may be right. We may be wrong. That's not the issue, really. Science is a process of allowing those people to, like, bring their minds together, disagree, and then come to conclusions that tend toward the truth via the process of correction, via data, logic, exchange of ideas. I mean, those are all, like, fundamental to the way science works.
Yeah.
On campus, what happened was just at that point, like, basically, it just got crazier and crazier for me personally. Right. Because I was on TV a lot. Right. So before the pandemic, I'd never been on TV. I'd never written an op-ed, but I'm on TV a lot. And it just so happens that the most typical place I'd be on TV is on Fox. I occasionally get CNN or whatever, but I'd get hate mail no matter where I went on. But I was on Fox. Right. And that really made a lot of my colleagues unhappy because Fox is a conservative news station. And most of my colleagues are on the left. Why did I go on Fox? Because they invited me. I'm in public health. I'm supposed to speak to everybody, regardless of their political bent. I've never signed up for a political party because I always viewed it as my job to be able to speak to everyone, regardless of the politics. I don't actually care that much about politics, which is a strange thing to say, sitting in the middle of this massive, apparently, political debate. But I really don't. I care about science. I care about epidemiology. I care about public health. I care about vulnerable people.
Right. That's why we'll go into public health. We could have made a lot more money going into clinical stuff.
I mean, it's intellectually challenging. There are many, many things to talk about it, but like what, one of the things that is absolutely true about public health is you have to be able to reach almost everybody. Right. I mean, in that sense, public health is completely, it's not like politics where 50 plus one and you've succeeded. You got to reach everybody. Now, in that sense, I guess I've failed too, right? Like I haven't reached everyone, but
I think you've reached quite a lot of people, way more than you know. I've been told that I have also, you've had a lot more media coverage than I have. Most of mine has also been on right-sided media, although I did a CNN interview once. They touched me, I pushed back, and they never pushed again.
I think I saw that interview. It was quite something, actually.
And unfortunately, I wasn't as well prepared then about what I was talking about as I am now. I could do a much better job, but anyway.
But, you know, science is iterative, right? Like we learn from sure. those kind of interactions. But, you know, on campus, what happened then, at one point I did a video with Governor DeSantis about child masking. Particularly, the question was like, is there any good evidence that child masking reduces the spread of the disease? And I told him I knew to be 100% fact, because I prepared for this, that moment. I said that there are no randomized studies that demonstrate any efficacy of child masking. In fact, there are no randomized studies about child masking at all.
Zero over zero.
This got me kicked off YouTube, which is, you know, that's another story. But on campus, what it led to was really shocking. There was a campaign up to put a poster of me on all around campus, on kiosks all around campus, including by a coffee shop that I go to all the time, with a picture of me. And then when in the summer wave, when COVID was hitting Florida really hard in 2021, they put a picture of the wave of cases or deaths in Florida, pointing to me as the cause of the COVID spreading or something. Ironically, COVID has had during the COVID pandemic years, there has been less all cause excess deaths in Florida than there has been in California.
Right.
Where I live.
Right. Now,
I was actually physically scared to go on campus, and I complained about this. I'm like, look, you guys talk about safe spaces. You've permitted, by essentially marginalizing me on campus, this environment where it's okay to completely demonize me, to smear me, to essentially lie about positions that I have, to misrepresent the results of complicated policy debates, and the administration did nothing.
Well, right. It put you in a bad position, because the only way they would actually do something is by some legal force or some embarrassment force. If the university gets embarrassed over something, then they'll do something. But you inside the university don't really embarrass it much.
I mean, it was heartbreaking, because I've been at Stanford for 36 years, Harvey.
Well, right. You expected some recognition of your value to the institution.
Well, I mean, yes, but also more than that, like, this is my home. Like I was an undergrad. I was a very young man when I first landed here. I was 18. Yeah. I feel like Stanford paraphernalia basically everywhere. And actually, in 2020, I decided I was going to throw it away. Luckily, I didn't, because my view now is that it's the people that did this response that violated the norms of the university that should throw away their Stanford paraphernalia.
Right. Well, you know, the problem is, universities, like democracies, are very slow to take action. They tolerate a lot of malfeasance before they're willing to actually mount a response. And it's a problem, because in a more perfect world, we'd want them to mount responses in proportion to what's happening.
I mean, the response, it just got worse, right? So like at one point in 2021, one of my colleagues in epidemiology, she's not directly in my department, she's in the Department of Epidemiology straight, wrote a petition asking the president of the university to censor me over my views on child masking. Mm-hmm. Now, they didn't mention me directly by name, but they used a quote from this roundtable I did with Governor DeSantis. It was very clear who they were aiming it at. Mm-hmm. And then sent it to the the chair of epidemiology, who then circulated it to the rest of the other people within the medical school.
Wait, the chair of epidemiology circulated it?
Yeah.
That there's legal issues there.
I don't want to sue Stanford.
Not necessarily Stanford, but the person. But anyway, all these things are bad. I know.
At this point, there's too many hurts to like. I mean, I think the way to talk is just to talk publicly about it. That's the best. Yeah. That's the best way to do it, to manage this. At that point though, I was much more media savvy than I was in 2020. And so what I did is I got some. I told some of my friends in the media about this story. They went and interviewed the president of the university, asking the president if he intended to censor me. And of course, they have to like maintain the form that Stanford has academic freedom. So he was forced to say no, he wasn't planning to censor me. Which I think embarrassed the people who did the petition. The petitioners, they sent it to a junior faculty. I had people writing to me saying like they felt pressured to sign it.
This is abuse. This is academic abuse. We don't have the academic freedom to demand censorship of our colleagues. The academic freedom ends when you get hit in the face with the fist.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing. I mean, it's like one thing if they would debate me, right?
Right. Right. If they disagree with you and so vehemently that they can't stand your ideas, then let them debate you.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was the tenor of what it was like to do work at Stanford during the pandemic. I mean, and Harvey, I sat here looking at your situation, thinking that you must have gone through very similar things. I don't know if you talk much publicly about them, but it must have been very difficult for you.
Well, actually, I think I'm just much more naive than you are. And I didn't go out of my way to push very hard on things publicly, except for the early treatment stuff, which I knew cold, and the scientific evidence, was cold. And I don't do social media. I didn't even have a Telegram channel in those years. And So I don't play he said she said on debating people because they're scoffers and they're not there to do a real debate. They're just there to say no, you don't know what you're talking about and you're not qualified and all that stuff. So when my colleagues wrote the letter that they posted on Medium saying that I had no experience in infectious diseases and everything, all my studies are not randomized trials, and on and on and on. They wrote this long screed that was ridiculous, not even doing due diligence on their part to see what my degrees are in. I just ignored it. They could put out there, I've done some legal cases and deposing attorneys have asked me about that. And I say, my response is, Yale has academic freedom. They can write anything they want. And
doesn't make it true,
right? And right, doesn't make it true. Let the readers decide whose science is better, and that's all I say about it.
I mean, I think it's funny from like sitting at Stanford, looking at Yale, there were a number of very abusive colleagues of yours online and elsewhere, like who behaved incredibly unprofessionally within the field of public health,
right?
With Yale professorships. And your behavior has been entirely gentlemanly. I mean, I would feel for you whenever there was some terrible attack, because I would think, okay, how is Harvey holding up? How is it possible to like withstand this and not fight back? Whereas like some of the professors on the other side were just they were just vicious. They would smear anyone who disagreed with them, and often not just other professors. I mean, there's just one thing. It's like, gladiators in a cage match or something.
Right, right.
But regular people.
Well, fortunately, my wife is an attorney, and we would talk about these things, and she's got the common sense and wisdom in the family. And so it was very easy to talk me down into rational, logical things to do, which is not to respond. And so I would just ignore it. Why give something else air that it doesn't have of itself? They get 10 views, 100 views, and I get 300,000 views. I mean, I'm not going to promote them into my stratosphere.
I think that was a wise response. Your wife is very wise. I mean, I've tried to do that also. I did eventually join Twitter in August of 2021, and my strategy on Twitter has been to not respond to provocation. I'll respond to legitimate arguments that disagree with me made in good faith, which is a lot of times that's true. And frankly, I've had to check myself to like make sure that I don't misread other people who are acting in good faith. Just because they're disagreeing with me doesn't mean ipso facto they're not acting in good faith.
Right.
You have to suppress that idea too, because otherwise science doesn't work. I don't know if I've always got it right, but I think that has to be the spirit.
Well, I've had over the last 3 years, more than 120,000 emails. And I've tried to answer almost all of them in the last.
Oh, Harvey, I had that many. I haven't come close to answering.
Well, in the last 6 months, it's been a little difficult otherwise I would be up all night, which I am anyway, answering emails. But in all of that, hundreds and hundreds of people agreeing with me, doctors, I mean, agreeing with me, and here and there, people disagree. And I've had about three actual rational conversations with people who disagree with me, who I, you know, argued back and forth with. And eventually, I think they either gave up or came around. I think the problem is that people don't understand that our arguing is based on scientific understandings, not authority, not who says it, not the most prestigious epidemiologists disagree with you. You know, not the WHO disagrees with you. You know, that's not science. That's not it. Karl Popper, the philosopher, said that studies about what scientists believe have no relationship to studies about how nature behaves. It doesn't matter who says anything. If you disagree with me, go read my papers. Go read the science that the papers refer to. Think about the studies and draw your own conclusions from them. You don't have to believe me.
There's a famous anecdote from that Einstein, at one point, 100 German physics professors, you know, very upset that he was Jewish, wrote in response to his general theory of relativity that it was all wrong. Wrote this book accusing him in crazy ways, essentially being wrong. Some very prominent professors, and his response to the 100 was, "Well, if they're right and I'm wrong, it wouldn't take 100; it would take just one."
Exactly.
I mean, it's been heartbreaking. I don't know. What do you think it's possible to get the universities back? Universities like Harvard or like Yale or Stanford to get back to a place where they can actually be places where, in health policy and epidemiology, people can actually have honest conversations with one another that disagree with each other. I mean, it seems to me like if the answer to that question is no, not only the university's in trouble, but our culture and our politics around health policy, public health, and epidemiology are in deep trouble.
Well, I would answer that, except we have to take another break. Okay. So let's take a break now, and everybody come back, and we'll be right back.
America Out Loud beats to the pulse of our nation. We know when you're angry, you're troubled, confused, glad, and thankful. Well, we know you because we are you. AmericaOutLoud.com. Join us as we explore the most important issues of our time. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep is infuriating. Your mind races, you toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's fast-paced digital age makes it tougher. You're not alone. Poor sleep affects over 70% of us. The CDC even labeled insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. Advanced nutrition company, Healthy Cell, created REM Sleep to help you quickly fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deep, and wake refreshed. Unlike other supplements that don't work, REM Sleep is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients, supporting all four stages of sleep using calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support. Over 1,000 reviews with an average star rating of over 4.4 proves it works. Take back your sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order, risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com, code OUTLOUD. HealthyCell.com, code OUTLOUD.
So we've been talking about whether public health and universities will ever get back to a plane where people on opposing sides of ideas will actually be able to discuss and argue and debate. And the answer to that is, it took three or four generations to get here. It's going to take at least as many generations to go back. And I think it's actually much deeper, because I think any innovation in science always leads to rejection and an argument. And the prime example for that was Semmelweis and his hand washing in pregnancy deliveries, that he was driven crazy by his colleagues. And, you know, and he was right, of course, in reducing the infection risk in deliveries by just simple hand washing. You know, public health does not have a lot of deep science behind most of it. And so the problem because of that is, I think that it's more easily politically affected than things that are straightforward science. Now, I used to think that the amount of argument was inversely proportional to the scienciness of a field, so that physics should have less argument and psychology should have more argument. And I was disabused of that my first week in college, when I went to a physics colloquium by some visiting Danish physicist, and three rows behind me was the astrophysicist Fritz Zwicky, who at the end asked him a question, didn't get the answer he liked, and ramped it up to the point where he hopped over the rows and started to try to punch the speaker. And Carl Anderson, the head of the department, had to separate them. And I thought, if this is the way physics is, I'm not going to be a physicist.
I think getting passionate about science is fine. I mean, punching people in the name of getting passionate, that's a different thing. In every field worth studying, the edge of the fields are going to be disputed. It's places we don't know the answer.
Right.
And it's one of the, I don't know, like your answer frankly depresses me, Harvey. Three or four generations.
Oh, well, but there's a very famous line in the Talmud that says, things that are difficult require a first step. So you're not allowed to desist from starting, even though you know that you'll never finish it.
Well, I don't plan to stop.
Well, it's in my nature as well as yours, you know,
yeah,
to do what's right.
I think, I don't know what solves all the problems, but I do think that, like you mentioned earlier, these very famous statements, like the Chicago statement on free speech and academic freedom, that was the product of leadership. It was controversial at the time that those stances were taken, and they were often stances that were trying to defend the capacity of people on the left being able to speak.
Right, that's right. That's really an interesting point. So you're saying that in those eras, the people on the left felt themselves outnumbered in a university setting and were looking to increase their academic power, so to speak.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I guess I'd do a little more positive spin on it, right? So you had university leadership who didn't necessarily share the commitments on the left, but had a commitment to a deep commitment to this value of universities, a place where those ideas could be exchanged, even if they themselves found those ideas wrong or repulsive or dangerous or whatever.
Right, but I also think there was a lot more faculty in the middle. There was a lot more centrism in life in the university in those eras.
So I guess the experiment to resolve our dispute is, I think that if university leadership were to take a very firm stance in favor of the old-fashioned liberal consensus, liberal in the small L,
right,
John Stuart Mill kind of liberalism's consensus, where free speech is a fundamental foundation of the university, and that without it, you don't have a university that's worth talking about. That you can't do science, you can't do you. There's really no purpose in it. In it, you're just teaching dogma rather than trying to discover truth. I mean, if the leadership of universities, like major prominent universities, you know, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, and so on, were to issue like not just issue a statement, but like honestly sign on to this idea of the old-fashioned liberal university, I think it could have a tremendous impact relatively quick. I mean, not a day or two, but like within years rather than generations.
Well, I'm not holding my breath for your president nor my president, who I like very much. I've known Peter Salovey since I first came to Yale. I was on one of his grants and research projects at the very beginning when I came, and I know him, but I don't think he has the force of character to be that independent of everything going on around him. And I don't know Harvard very well.
I'll tell you, I think the key thing is not even the presidents. What needs to happen is that the people who choose the president, the board of trustees, the alumni, essentially the people who are like, residual claimants for the university. Very often the residual claimant is not money. It's like, you know, prestige or social power. Those people need to decide that that's what they want. That the universities, as they're currently constituted, have this tremendous cultural cachet. Everyone wants to send their kid to Yale or Harvard or Stanford or whatever. But that cultural cachet is actually ephemeral. That it's, in fact, unless it's backed up by a real commitment to a liberal university, that won't last forever.
I think they think it'll last forever, and I think there's a monoculture on the left in these boards of trustees now, and I don't think that as much as we've tried to elect members of the board by independent voting, not the ones they propose. They've locked that out of possibility. They passed a resolution disallowing independent candidates for the board of trustees.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that that's a problem. I mean, it's been interesting to watch DeSantis in Florida. He appointed a relatively conservative board of overseers. I'm not sure. I don't think I have the terminology right, but whatever they call it in Florida, over the University of Florida system.
Well, there he had external control over it because it's a public university. The private universities, there's no kind of equivalent check and balance. And I think that there would have to be a major crisis before anything like this would actually get their attention where they think the risk is worth it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the crisis would have to be something like the status of the universities would start to decline within society, right? So there are things like, I've seen some companies say that they're not interested in hiring people from Stanford because the kids that go to Stanford will cause more trouble than they're worth.
Well, how about Yale law students clerking for certain judges?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of pushback I'm talking about. Like when we start having trouble placing our students because we are doing such a bad job inculcating them basic values, basic liberal values of tolerance that are absolutely vital in any profession when they leave. That's when I think the people will start to like notice, because you know it feels like places like Stanford, Harvard, and so on are too big to fail. And in one sense they are. They have huge amounts of money and so on and power. But the cultural power is relative. If there are other places within the culture that replace the cultural power of these big institutions, they'll take notice. Like the branding turns out to be incredibly important to these big universities.
Well, the part of the problem is that where they see that influence is only one-sided, which will value the allegiance more than the freedom.
Yeah, I think that there needs to start being a cost paid for that.
I agree. I think that's true.
And part of it is, I think, I'm not going to be a general that solves this, like fights this full war. But I'm a lieutenant, right? So here I am in the trenches of Stanford, and I plan when there's excesses to speak up more. something I never did before the pandemic, because I thought I'd just go on with my work and that was how I would make the world better. But I find myself in a place where I have a platform to speak up when there are abuses and excesses that threaten the liberal commitments of Stanford, liberal small l toward, you know, right, free speech and so on.
No, I think that's right. I think that's great. You know, you're going to look back on your career with a lot of satisfaction that you've done this.
I think we have to, like, there are a lot of like-minded people in these universities. I don't really think anyone wants to live in this, like, almost Maoist culture where we're looking over our shoulders, worried about what our fellow professors think of us.
Well, I have a few people in the School of Public Health at Yale who do.
Yeah, but I think they're the minority. I think most people...
But I think they terrorize everybody.
Yeah, that's, they do. That's just it. So, like, you know, like the typical professor at Stanford, Harvard, Yale, wherever, Oxford, they're not interested in these fights. They just want to do their work. They got into this because they love discovering new things, reading texts in an interesting way, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And they just want to do their work. They don't want to worry about this nonsense. And I think we will, if we can get people like that to understand, they don't have to like be leaders of the movement, but they have to push back when there's this bullying. Like we have to essentially, because I actually don't think it's everybody. You mentioned earlier about in the earlier generation, the vast middle agreed. I think it's still true, Harvey. I think the vast middle in these universities actually do still agree. I don't mean middle in the sense of politics left or right. I mean the middle in the sense of like still have these liberal commitments, these small L commitments to what a university ought to be.
I think you're right, but I think they're scared because of the threats of censorship, job loss, collegiality, and whatever that are coming from one strident side of this that's terrorizing everybody, and nobody knows how to stand up to them without getting called more vicious names, you know, that are totally unwarranted.
Well, that's my superpower and yours, Harvey. We're now so used to being called vicious names that it doesn't really hurt us anymore.
I still don't like it.
But yeah, I think, I mean, it's I don't know. Maybe we won't live to see one way or the other, but I do think that if I'm right, that there are strategies that are possible to reform our universities so that they can return. Because, you know, it's too important. The universities played such a negative role, I think, in the pandemic response. Essentially, as narrative enforcers for hugely mistaken policies like school closures, essentially like lockdowns that led to hundred million people being thrown into poverty worldwide.
Right. Don't forget fake modeling.
Well, I mean, that's what led to the lockdown. It basically an inducement of panic not on the basis of actual data, but on the basis of assumptions that turned out to be tremendously off.
Right.
And so I think there's the public is also a constituency for these universities, since the output from these universities affect the public so much, especially the top private universities, I think. And I think that those are a lot of allies we have on our side as a consequence of the pandemic.
They have to speak. They have to be willing to be public, to sign.
We have to give them we have to figure out how to marshal their power, because the power they have is way more than the universities and the small number of people inside the universities that want to bully their ideological opponents into silence and turn the university into an illiberal institution. I might be wrong. I don't know. I'm still thinking through these, and that's why I was glad when you invited me to this podcast to have a chance to think through some of these issues with you.
Well, you know, in my case, I was very lucky because I had a path that kind of skirted in between all of the, you know, the sides, the absorbing, the mathematical absorbing states on the sides, you know, that allowed me to navigate and convey what I thought was accurate science, or as best I understood it, for all things COVID that I've done with relatively minimal damage along the way to reputation which is all that I care about, because the messages that I have come from my being accurate. And that's all there is that one should strive for, is to be accurate in your understandings of things. So yeah,
I want to know true things. I mean, that's the reason to go into academics, really, is to help in the great stream of conversation that results in the truth being learned over time.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's too bad we weren't at the same institution.
It would have been really fun arguing. We would have been arguing all the time. It would have been great.
Oh, I would never have gotten any work done. As it is, I have colleagues who I would, you know, talk to from time to time, but it was usually just not COVID related. It was just something else that was going on, and never had a solution, but at least it felt I was talking to somebody.
Yeah. I mean, it is still, I believe, a great job. At least one day can be again a great job. The purpose of our institutions is to inform the public on the most vital, important things, on science, on policy, on a whole host of ideas. Issues. That's our job. I mean, like, and it's a great privilege that we've been given that job. And it's a source of tremendous sadness to me to see that our institutions have failed to maintain the atmospheres where that job could be done with honesty.
Well, I agree. And it's also saddening to me that we don't learn from history, that in our lifetimes or in a few generations of lifetimes, we've seen two other instantiations of the failed corruption of science for political values that ruined the science and ruined the societies. You know, and we haven't learned anything from that. And we think, oh, we're going to do it ourselves. We're going to, you know, the people here think, oh, we're going to try the experiment again, and we know better. They didn't know how to do it, but we know better. You know, all 70 times this has been tried and failed, and we're somehow going to, you know better. It's silly.
I mean, it could be deeper than universities, right? Is science simply just a source for power? Like it's a way to gain power over.
Are we the magical priests of science? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, is that all this is, or is it just a source of? It's a process by which we slowly arrive at a better and truer understanding about the way the physical world works.
Oh, that is it for sure. I was a curious person, but before I could talk, my parents used to say, I would always point at things and want to know their names and what they did before I could talk.
I mean, that's the thing. That's like what we are born wanting to know, wanting to learn. We're like curious. We're almost, I mean, that's like almost our defining characteristic as humans is this desire to like learn from the very beginning. And I think if our institutions like Stanford or Harvard or Yale or whatever, Oxford can't like respect the kinds of policies or establish the kind of culture that allows that to happen, they really don't deserve to continue functioning the way they have. They don't deserve the cultural cachet they currently have.
It's true. And unfortunately, we have to leave it here. We've run out of time, so we're going to have to come back another time and continue this wonderful discussion. This has been really great. I hope our listeners have enjoyed this. And I'm sure if they have questions, they can send them, and I'll send them to you, Jay, also, if I get any questions about this at americaoutloud.com/pulse. So Jay, thank you. This was really amazing discussion, and I enjoyed it. And thanks everybody for listening, and please come back next week.